Welcome to the Business Leadership Series, where we engage with leaders who are making an impact on their worlds and who want to share their knowledge and experience for your personal and professional growth. The following interview is designed to inspire you to become the best leader you can be. Your host, Derek Champagne, is the founder and CEO of The Artist Evolution, a full-service agency building successful brands, marketing tools, and campaigns, and also the author of the best-selling book, Don't Buy a Duck. And now, let's begin today's Leadership Series interview.
Welcome to the Business Leadership Series, where our goal is to inspire you to become the best leader that you can be. Today in the studio, we have Steve Dorff. He is the author of the new book, I Wrote That One Too, A Life in Songwriting from Willie to Whitney. I'm honored to have him in the studio with us. He's one of the most successful songwriters and composers of the last 25 years. He's penned over 20 top 10 hits for pop and country artists around the world, including Barbara Streisand, Celine Dion, Blake Shelton, Smokey Robinson, Kenny Rogers, Ray Charles, Anne Murray, Whitney Houston, George Strait, Dolly Parton, Judy Collins, Cher, Dusty Springfield, Ringo Starr, Garth Brooks, and more. He scored for television shows such as Growing Pains, Murphy Brown, Murder, She Wrote, Reba, and then several films such as Any Which Way But Loose. He has also embarked on a musical theater with the show Josephine for Broadway. Dorff has also been nominated for more than 40 BMI Awards, an American Music Award, the NSAI Songwriter of the Year Award, 3 Grammy and 6 Emmy nominations, 28 motion picture scores, 12 number one hits, and over 400 songs recorded by notable artists spanning from all genres. Steve, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're here in Northwest Arkansas. Is this your first time here?
Yes, first time.
Tell us why you're here.
Well, I came in for the I'll Fly Away Music Festival, which is happening all this weekend. I was invited to come in and do a show tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. at the Haxson Studios in Bentonville.
Yes. Okay. I know the owner of that studio. It's a great spot. Why is it important to you to do an event like this and to be part of, I know there's a whole songwriting workshops happening all weekend. Why is it important to you to be involved in something like this?
Well, I have a book out that I wrote that came out in November, and it's my memoir, and so I'm kind of touring with that. I think what's important for songwriters like me, who are fairly anonymous, we're not the face of our songs. Nobody knows who we are.
Right.
I'm this Oz behind the curtain guy who has written the soundtrack to a lot of people's lives, and nobody has any idea who I am, which is fine. You know, the face of the songs are the artists who make them famous, like Kenny Rogers or Barbara Streisand or Celine Dion or George Strait.
Right.
So it's, to answer your question, I do some of these festivals and performances to help educate people that there are people like me who just sit in lonely rooms and sit at the piano or at their guitar and write songs and dream about having great artists sing them.
Let's get right into the book. I've got it right here. Mm-hmm. I wrote that one too, A Life in Songwriting from Willie to Whitney. I love this book.
Oh, thank you.
One of the things I love about it is there name dropping? Yes, because you write for some of the biggest names ever in music. But You share real experiences of your childhood, of how alcohol affected it as a child. You're forward. You talk about your son who you have, we're going to talk about today with the Memorial Fund, which is, and you're so open in even a chapter where you talk about love. I fall in love again, mm-hmm. and again. And I love that. Right. And I think about the great songwriters of when they're sitting there in their moments of pain or joy, and their expression is to write.
That's where the songs come from.
Yeah.
You know, which is a very frequently asked question. Well, what were you thinking about when you wrote, you know, so-and-so, or what inspires you to write a song? And the truth for me, it's always organic. It's always comes from a place of experience, something that I've experienced, whether it be painful or joyful. That's where they come from.
You talk about this old upright piano that you had for your first charted song, and you still have it in your house to this day.
Mm-hmm.
What does that symbolize for you? You wake up in the middle of the night and you'll go write a song on that.
Not really. Sleep's too important. it's symbol. I rented that piano in college, and for $12 a month, and wrote some great songs on it. And it sits in my bedroom, and it's probably terribly out of tune because I never play it, because I have a big Yamaha downstairs that I play. But it does symbolize where I've come from and how far a journey it's been.
You, it was really interesting to me as you talk about at a very early age, how I remember Snowball Fight.
Yes.
And you're hearing music and you're composing in your head. Yeah. And I wondered, and my son is about to turn 7, and he looks at the world a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. Not sports, not the same things. What do you say to either somebody that looks at the world differently and maybe has been discouraged, or what do you say to a parent of a child who looks at the world differently like you did? But you were really creating these things in your head and have gone on to do these amazing things as a result.
Well, my parents did not understand it. They thought I was from outer space. You know, I would be getting hit from all sides by balls of ice and musicalizing the whole thing. And then I'd ask my friends, or I remember distinctly watching a Little League game and one of my friends hit a home run, and I turned to my mom and I said, "How did you hear that?" And she looked at me like, "What did you say?" And I said, "Well, how did you hear that?" Because I was hearing a whole symphony as he was rounding the bases. And I just assumed that everybody did that, right? Why would I not?
Right.
You know, everybody's seeing, everybody's hearing, everybody's touching and feeling. It's a sense thing. And so with my kids, I have 4 kids, and all very different, all very creative in their own ways. I have one in particular. My oldest daughter does not see the world the way my other 3 do. And but yeah, I just encourage them to follow their dream.
Because
that's what I did.
I love it. Your book is, you talk about the ups and downs. So there's failures, there's waiting, there's uncredited things happening. It's great because it shows a struggle and a journey. And so even though you've done these amazing things, it was not always just something that was handed to you.
No, it's a roller coaster. I think any form of show business is or maybe even in any business, it's there are tremendous highs in songwriting and tremendous lows, not much in between. It's a tough business, as I think probably being an actor or an actress or a screenwriter. It's a lot of being at the right place at the right time. In my case, it's a lot of manifest destiny, you know, wishing and putting yourself, dreaming yourself into accomplishing those things, and then all of a sudden they happen. You know, I'll follow that by saying I wanted to be shortstop for the New York Yankees and hit a home run out of Yankee Stadium, but all the manifest destiny in the world would not make that happen. So,
And you were persistent as well, though.
Yeah,
you had this amazing talent, but you also talk about persistence.
Yeah, I think tenacity and talent, a lot of T's. Too dumb to know any better. I think it all goes towards having success. I think persistence and again, putting yourself in the right place to make things happen. If you sit and wait for the phone to ring, this is not a business to be in.
Right.
You got to make that phone ring.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, there's so many moments in the book, and I'm not going to spoil them, but there's chapters like Reba and Ringo Starr.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, just so many names of my heroes. One of my favorite stories, though, and I'm actually going to pull it up real quick from, I think it's chapter 13, Kenny Rogers Through the Years, which is an iconic, amazing song.
Well, thank you.
And you had, and here's, the chapter starts, "Every once in a while you finish a song and just have the undeniable feeling that you've written something important or special. It's one of the world's best feelings, and unfortunately, it doesn't happen often enough. But that happened to you on that occasion."
It did.
And to have, for whatever reason it happened, however they heard about the song, you have Lionel Richie mm-hmm. and Kenny Rogers both wanting to sing that song.
Right.
Kenny wins, Lionel produces. I mean, it's just, I love that chapter.
I mean, you know.
I love two of my heroes.
How do you plan that? You know, the truth is, and a lot of people over the years, pardon the pun, have asked me, how long did it take you to write that song? And I always say 30 years. It took me 30 years to get good enough to write that song. The truth is, it took me 12 minutes. Marty Panzer came over one night for dinner and opened an envelope, as he often did, and handed me a lyric, finished lyric, and I looked at it, and as I was reading it, I started hearing the tune in my head. And I yelled into my wife and I said, how long before dinner? And she said, oh, about 15 minutes. So I grabbed Marty and we went to the piano and we finished it. And but I could not have done that if I hadn't had the 30 years before that of struggling for hours with certain songs or spending days trying to perfect a line of a song. And it's craft, you know, it's learning your craft and learning how to do it. Take shortcuts, shorthand, and just, you know, eliminating all the stuff all the mistakes that you make along the way.
Pure Country, I remember early 90s being in 11th grade. And I can tell you who I was with. I can tell you the emotions. I remember, as a Dusty, the character Dusty. Yeah. I remember when Across My Heart came on and played, and I watched it on the big screen. I remember the first time I heard that, and all my friends do, all musician buddies. And I love that song. It takes me back to that moment of time. And just even when the montage of that, where he's playing it quietly and then it comes out on the, and then he's playing in front of an arena, just so powerful. Love that movie. Love that song. Played it with my daughter last week, showing her. I said, this guy's coming in. And
it's
so cool. Tell me about some of your other inspiration, because yes, it's a craft in 30 years, but you do write from your heart too.
Oh, yeah. I think all these songs come from experiences I've experienced. And I Crossed My Heart was one of those songs that just kind of fell out one day. I was working with my good buddy Eric Kaz, great songwriter, and we just sat down and started goofing around on the piano, and out came this song. And it was a struggle getting, you know, that song took about 8 years to, you know, that's the funny thing. People hear these songs on the radio and have no idea what the journey is behind all these songs. They're like kids themselves. You know, once they're born, once they're written, they're born. And then the trip and the journey is to get them on the radio and become hits. And some happen very quickly. In the case of I Crossed My Heart, that was recorded. The demo we did originally, we heard it as a boys to men kind of song, and actually demoed it that way and got nowhere with it.
Okay.
And then cut to about 3 years in and Bette Midler records it. And it went nowhere. It was not a great recording. Never came out. And then I got a call from a director of a movie that I was hired to do, Pure Country. Chris Kane, the director, called me one night and he said, you know, I'm still looking for that quintessential love song for the end of the movie. He said, do you have anything? I've listened to about 100 songs and I hate them all. And I said, you know, I've tried to write one, but I'm not coming up with anything. I said, you know, I've got this song that I think I can't write a better song for this spot than this older song. He said, well, play it for me. And I went over to his house and played him I Crossed My Heart. And he said, that's it. and George did not love it when we played it for him.
Wow.
He gave us a bit of a hard time about recording it because it wasn't the kind of thing that he normally does. Okay. And I always tell artists and people in Nashville now that it's those out of the box songs that have a little bit of a different spin on the ball, which most of mine do. Those are the ones that become career songs for people. Certainly, Every Which Way But Loose was that for Eddie Rabbit, and I like to think that I crossed my heart was that for George.
Back to the book. This is a must read. I've really enjoyed it. I goosebumps reading it. Again, living in LA for a little while, I recognized some of the studios or roads you were talking about. Right. It just brought it very, very real. But the whole style that it's written, it's a nice roller coaster. It's just fun to go through the journey with you, but you had to live it. It's a lot easier for us to go and read through it this way. How cool. What a journey you've had. With everything that you've had, there's so many things that you've done. You're so successful. More than 40 BMI awards, American Music Awards, 3 Grammys, and 6 Emmy nominations, and it goes on and on. 28 motion picture scores, 12 number one hits, over 400 songs recorded by notable artists spanning all genres. What motivates you, and what does success look for you now that you've done all of these things?
Well, the answer to the first part is I'm still so passionate about music, and I love writing songs. I can't hang a picture on the wall straight. So it was all I was ever meant to do, I think, in this life. And I still love it. I hear people in conversations say something, buzzwords, and I go, that could be a title. And that's just how my brain works. Right. In terms of success, when you're going through it, when you're going through the life, there are struggles and ups and downs, and it's not all fun. It's just life like everybody has. For me, I think having those bucket list things happen along the way means success to me. And certainly the Songwriters Hall of Fame induction this June is the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for any songwriter. I mean, when I was nominated, I thought, wow, I'm not going to get in, but at least I made the ballot. And then when I got the call that I was being inducted on the first ballot, it was just, it's still surreal to me.
Yeah.
It's, because you look at the names in that Hall of Fame, from Bacharach and David to Irving Berlin to Lennon and McCartney, and to be just on the same wall as those guys is, that's... If I never get another song recorded, that's it.
Yeah. And what I love about that, and it seems to me that this is who it happens to, is that's not why you started out. There's people that try to get into showbiz to be in showbiz for that. You just, from a young age, it's just you've been all about expressing
all about
and
music,
writing
yeah.
music.
Yeah.
And so. I think that is, it couldn't happen to a better person, more deserving, because you represent the purest form of the art. Mm. And I love it. And to me, music is, and songwriting is, one of the purest forms of storytelling, because it can pull on the emotions. It can take you back to a place in time. You can remember everything about it, the experience you had, the taste, the food, the weather, everything. And so I'm like, you brought me back with the Cross My Heart song. And so many others. And it's amazing that you can do that for so many people through songwriting that will live on forever. Is there anything else right now on your bucket list, or that is coming up, or that you have yet to do that you're going, this is something I've got to do next?
Well, there are always voices I hear that I go, wow, would I love Keith Urban to record one of my songs. Just great artists. I love working with great artists. I'm such a fan of great voices, and I've been so blessed to have worked with so many amazing, talented artists. That never stops for me. I'll hear someone on the radio, Carrie Underwood or Kelly Clarkson, and go, I gotta get a song with one of those. So that keeps you young. It keeps you relevant. Keeps you involved. And that's I can't see me doing anything else.
I love it. Look, I want to talk for a minute and to say sorry for your loss doesn't even close to cover it. But I do know that you want to honor your son's memory. And so can we talk for just a minute about the memorial fund, because I want to make sure that...
Absolutely. My son, Andrew Dorff, was a incredible songwriter, lyricist, moved to Nashville, lived there for 14 years, struggled, and then became one of the best and most beloved songwriters in that town. He just celebrated his fifth number one with Rascal Flatts. A song called Yours If You Want It.
Yeah.
And wrote Save It for a Rainy Day by Kenny Chesney. Neon Light by Blake Shelton. Just a great writer. And tragically, a month after he wrote the foreword to my book, had a tragic accident. And we lost him. And so my son and I, Stephen Dorff, the actor, have created the Andrew Marshall Dorff Memorial Fund, which benefits child oncology at Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville, and also an endowment for a music scholarship at Belmont College in Nashville. So we're going to do annual events in Nashville, concerts. The first one being this October 2nd at the Franklin Theater in Tennessee, Nashville. And there'll be some great artists performing and raising money for kids that need it.
Thanks for sharing that. We'll put links out with that as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I want to be respectful of your time. I want to give another plug for the book. I wrote that one too, A Life in Songwriting from Willie to Whitney. Again, a pleasure to meet you. Every single chapter is awesome. Just the chapters themselves, Reba, Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
One last question though. Is there anyone, I mean, I know there were probably a few, but who was the biggest artist maybe that you worked with that you were either starstruck by or that just you could not believe you were in the moment? Because you've worked with all the A-listers.
Yeah, it had to be Ringo, because I was such a Beatles fan. It wasn't necessarily the best song or the best record I've ever been associated with, but in terms of a surreal moment of pushing the talk back button and saying, can you sing that again, Ringo? And then saying, what did I just say? And with a lot of expletives. That was, that had to be once in a lifetime. I mean, certainly working with Barbara Streisand and Kenny Rogers and Bill Medley of the Righteous Brothers was idolized Bill. I idolized Tom Jones. Getting to do an album with Tom was insane. Ann Murray, she recorded 11 of my songs. Over her career. Celine, I've been so blessed to have worked with some of the greatest voices in any generation. So,
and you've done so much with movies too, which we really didn't even touch on. But on your book, in the back, we've got Kenny Rogers, but we've got Clint Eastwood.
Yeah,
and I know Burt Reynolds as well, and several others.
Yeah.
But that's incredible. I like the relationship with Snuff Garrett throughout the book. It's fun seeing that woven in. Can you tell me more, just a little bit more about dynamic there?
Snuff brought me to California, and he was a great record producer and a very tough horse trader, as they say in the business. And as you can tell in the book, it's a double-edged sword. I learned a lot. I take some shots at Snuff because of some of the pay your dues type things I had to deal with. But at the end of the day, I have to thank him for opening a lot of doors and giving me the platform to shine and do what I do. Because without him, I would have had to take a different journey.
I think that comes through in the book too.
Uh-huh.
It does, but I do love that first call you get that Snuff had called you to call him back, and that first just that Hollywood experience of you had a charted song, but you're banging down doors, and I'm here, and not getting the calls back yet. That's really cool to have that.
I had a lot of doors slammed in my face, and he gave me my shot. He gave me he got me to California, moved me out there, set me up. Introduced me to the studio scene, kind of threw me into it when I maybe wasn't really ready yet, but forced me to be ready. And so, yeah.
Let's talk about the singing bee. Because that did put you in front of the camera.
Yeah, for the first time. That was I remember I was playing golf one day with a friend, and I got a call from my agent, and I saw she was calling, and I didn't take the call because I was playing golf, and the phone kept ringing. And so finally I called her back. I said, "What is it?" She said, "There's this, you know, producers show, they want you to do it. It's called The Singing Bee." I go, "What is that?" She says, "Well, it's kind of a reality game show." And I said, "Cheryl, I'm not going to do a game show." And I hung up on her. Hmm. And she kept calling me back, and she said, "Take a meeting with this guy." And so I did. And I walked in, and he was reading my resume and saying the first thing he said to me when I walked in, we shook hands. He said, "Nice to see you, Steve." He says, "You know, I don't think you're really right for this project." And I said, "Well, I don't either. So why, you know, let's just go to lunch." And
what am I doing?
Yeah, well, yeah. And but we had lunch, and he was telling me about it. And he said, "You know, I think it would be a good thing for you. You'd be in front of the camera for a minute, and you'd be kind of the Ed McMahon to Melissa Peterman's Johnny Carson, you know." Yeah. And it's great music, and it'd be fun. And my kids actually talked me into doing it. They said, "Yeah, it'd be fun to see you on TV." So we did it thinking it's going to be 10 episodes. Hmm. And it was a wheelbarrow of money. And for me to do, less than 3 weeks worth of work.
Wow.
And we ended up going 5 years.
Wow.
50 episodes, 5 seasons. The number one rated show on CMT for all those years. And I made some great relationships and friendships, and it was, looking back, it was a lot of fun.
That's so cool. I know that all your songs are your babies, but can you do two or three pop up at the top for you that are most endearing to you?
Probably ones that you never heard.
That's a great answer.
Truth be told, yeah. A song called "Something Bigger Than Me," that I wrote with Marty Panzer. A song called "Fall Softer," which has not been recorded yet, that I wrote with Kim Williams. Just pop into my head. And a song called "Backyard Sky," which probably might be my favorite song I've ever written. And it's about loss. It's hard to play. But get through now because it's kind of taken on a whole new meaning. I actually wrote it with Tina Schaefer almost 20 years ago after she lost her brother. Hmm. And she wrote the lyric, and I loved what the lyric said. So those three pop into my mind.
Are you thinking that you might keep that one for yourself? Or is it? Or what does that look like?
You know,
or
you just I've never really pitched that song. It's a very personal song to me. I don't know. I'd love for someone to do it. Obviously, it's some point. Maybe, you know, the journey of songs is it's always about right time, right place, right artist. Marriage between a song and an artist and a voice. And some of these don't ever get the opportunity to be heard by the right artist because time goes by and you have new things and they have new things. And so it's really, it's a matter of timing. You know, I say in the book, and it's a great analogy, most songwriters' catalogs are like icebergs. You know, you see 15% of an iceberg above water. Hmm. And with a music catalog, when you've written 2,000 songs, And you've maybe had, you know, 12 number ones, you know, that's less than 15%, is above the water. Everything else very rarely gets heard.
Wow.
So
That's a great answer. I love that. Let's go back to a couple of things in the book. Not to get political, but Donald Trump's in the story for a few seconds. I love that.
Yeah, he is. he hit on my wife. What can I tell you?
And you won.
It's old news.
You won.
Yeah, my second wife was second ex-wife was a dancer, and she was doing a trade show in at the Trump Casino in New Jersey. It was before we were married. Hmm. And Trump, President Trump, sent, he wasn't the president then, obviously, this was many years ago, sent one of his guys over, one of his wingmen over, and get that girl in the curly hair's number. And invited her up to his suite, and she ended up going up with a bunch of her friends, which bummed him out. but yeah, That's funny you mentioned that. I forgot about that.
I love it. There's hundreds of things like that in this book that are weaved in with the.
Well, it's kind of an anecdotal approach. A lot of the things that are in the book were kind of second and third thoughts. Once I turned the first draft in, my editor sent it back to me and said, "Now we need more detail. Detail. I want to know what Celine was wearing. I want to know, I want to know what Streisand said to you after you reacted to her performance." Those kinds of details, which I didn't put in the first draft,
right.
And it took me about three drafts to get some of that stuff in, and then of course some of the stuff I had to pull out because I didn't want to get sued. I think it's a nice combination of stuff in there.
It's a great balance. Yeah. I like when you talk about meeting Burt Bacharach, who you were a fan of, and then you found out that he was
idolized Burt. Yeah.
Walk me through that, to have someone like that. I know Ringo Starr was that way, but for then him come back and say, "I know who you are and I'm a big fan of what you're doing."
Yeah, I was on an airplane and I was back before 9/11, so there was no security. You could get to a plane, literally 30 seconds before they closed the door and just walk on. And I was sitting there and there was a seat next to me and I thought, okay, this is going to be good. I can relax. I don't have to talk to anybody. And here I hear a little last second noise up at the front, and I see this guy, disgruntled guy. He's breathing heavy because he thought he was going to miss his plane, and he's walking towards me, and he's looking for a seat. And I'm thinking, oh man, he's going to sit down next to me. And then I looked up again, and it was Burt Bacharach, and I went, what? And he sat down, and we ended up starting to talk, and he said, "What's your name?" And I told him my name, and he knew a couple of my songs. Wow. And I was blown away, yeah.
That's cool. Another story about that. You talk where you actually made a connection with recommending John Pagano to work together with him.
John Pagano, yeah.
Pagano, and they worked together for over 20 years.
Yeah, well, Burt, during our four-hour flight, it was from L.A. to Nashville, actually. He was going there to do a symphony date, and he invited me to the show, and I couldn't because I was in the studio that same night doing something else. During the flight, we were talking about arranging because he was my idol. A lot of what I incorporated into my style came from being a huge Burt Bacharach fan.
Wow.
And so I was asking him questions, and then he said, "Well, let me ask you something." He said, "I'm thinking about adding a guy to my group." He always used three girls as singers.
Okay.
And he said, "How would you voice that?" And because I don't want to put him in the bottom and have two girls. And I said, "No, if he's got a good enough range, I'd put him in the middle, put one girl, and I'm thinking to myself, he's asking me how to arrange voices? I mean, come on, this is one of the greatest arrangers in modern times. And he said, "Do you happen to know a really good singer?" And I just worked with this demo singer, John Pagano, from Rhode Island, I believe he's from, and great singer and a great guy. And I said, you ought to call this guy John Pagano. He's great. I don't think he's working that much. He'd probably love that gig, you know. And John, every time I see him, he always thanks me for, he's been working for Bird, I think, for 23 years now. Yeah.
How common is it in your industry to help one another that way?
I think it's common. Yeah. I mean, when I'm asked, I'm asked often, you know, who's a great female demo singer or who, you know, and I ask people sometimes because I want to get certain singers to do my demos that have a certain sound, and I don't keep up on all the new young, singers that a lot of the new writers are using. So, and every time I ask, I get a list or I'll get a number of someone, and it just happened actually a couple of weeks ago on a new song that I had just written that I was aiming to a particular artist, and I asked this songwriter friend of mine, hey, who would you use to sing this? And he came up with the name, and I used her, and she was fantastic. Wow.
So. That's a great break for them, too. Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about life being highs and lows, which I can relate to so much. My question is, in the lows, what's the mindset to have to get back to the next high? Like, what do you do during that time? A lot of people get stuck in failure and the low points and have a hard time ever coming out of it. Your book is filled with highs and lows, but you've been able to come out and have these big expressions in a big way and do these amazing things. I mean, it's more accomplishments that a lot of people never do in their lifetime. How do you get through that? What's a mindset for our listeners if they're going through something? What do you do?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I have a great answer. All I can relate to is my own experience. Yeah. I think a big low for me was going through a divorce, going through a very painful divorce where everything seemed to be out of sync. Everything in life was out of sync. You don't really realize it while it's happening, but all of a sudden nothing is working. You know, the phone's not ringing. The songs are not quite good enough. The rewrites aren't quite good enough. The gears are just slipping in every aspect of your life, it seems. And all you can do is ride it out and try to right the ship, which fortunately I was able to do. When Andrew passed away, of course, being a parent, getting that phone call is, there really are no words. It's the most excruciating pain, a parent can ever feel. It's a club I wouldn't wish on anybody to be in. It's, the best I can explain it is that, just someone came and chopped my arm off but you learn to live with one arm, and slowly you heal in certain ways. And for me, the foundation was one way of turning something somewhat positive, to know that you can help other people get through tough times. And then the writing started coming back. I wrote one song in 2017, and it was not very good. It was quite bad, actually. And I just shut down. And then and this year, all of a sudden, the Hall of Fame nomination came along right around Christmas, which was. I can tell this story because I can't make it up. I received the phone call telling me that I was being inducted almost to the minute of the phone call, of the worst phone call I ever received a year before.
Wow.
And what that did was restore a lot of faith because I know Andrew had something to do with me getting in. So.
Wow. Yeah, that's beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. Hey, again, thank you for coming by. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to Northwest Arkansas.
Thank you.
And, man, blessed to have you here and just excited I got to meet you and that we get
to
share your story.
This was really fun, and you asked great questions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Business Leadership Series, where we engage with leaders who are making an impact on their worlds and who want to share their knowledge and experience for your personal and professional growth. This interview was designed to inspire you to become the best leader you can be.